Part 4. Romantic Relationships. Ted Bundy was a heartbreaker with an expansive following of women who pined over him during and after his trial, sending him letters and cards, desperately wanting reciprocation. He was an articulate, charming, and well-groomed man with bright blue eyes and a penchant for sexual sadism, which sent some women over the edge with desire. He said, "It wasn't that I disliked women or were afraid of them. It was just that I didn't seem to have an inkling as to what to do about them. I honestly can't say why." In a separate interview, he also said, "I've always preferred women to men. I probably have 60% women friends and close to 40% men friends. It's always been divided that way. I enjoy women," which is the usual contradiction that is to be expected from a deceitful serial killer. In this section, we will study the most significant romantic relationships of Ted's life, including some lesser-known ones from his time in Utah. There are more, but because many of the women changed their names once Bundy became America's most famous serial killer, the information is extremely challenging to find. Once I manage to get the information from accurate sources, I will update this section for you. Diane Jean Edwards. Diane was a beautiful brunette woman from an affluent family who met Ted at the University of Washington in Seattle in 1967, where he was studying Chinese. He had a way with words and exuded confidence, which she was very attracted to. In an interview with an author, she said, "I was very caught up by his ability to talk. You know, he could just off the cuff come out with anything, and it sounded good, and he wrote fantastic letters." In his confession tapes, Ted said, "The relationship I had with Diane had a lasting impact on me. She's a beautiful dresser, a beautiful girl, very personable, nice car, great parents. So, you know, for the first-time girlfriend, really, that was not too bad." They took the relationship slowly, sleeping in the same bed for months before being intimate. Bundy lost his virginity with her, which took place in Walla Walla while he was working for Dan Evans on his Republican campaign. "We spent a lot of time driving around in her car, you know, making out in the car, mumbled sweet nothings into each other's ears and told each other how much we loved each other," he said, expressing how in love they both were with each other. Diane eventually broke off the relationship in 1968 because she felt that he just did not have the ambition and long-term career goals that she was looking for in a partner. She described him as immature and pitifully weak, which crushed his fragile ego and built up the rage and resentment that he unleashed on his victims, which were all young women that looked similar to her. American psychologist Dorothy Lewis said, "This was probably a pivotal time in his development, pinpointing this rejection as the beginning of a personal internal crisis for him. Heartbroken, he traveled to Colorado, Arkansas, and Philadelphia to visit relatives, enrolling in Temple University in Pennsylvania for 1 month. It is believed that on this trip he made a stop in Burlington, Vermont, and was able to see for himself that his birth records reflect an unknown father, which enraged him. He dropped out of college and re-enrolled in psychology at the University of Washington, graduating in 1972 with a Bachelor of Arts degree with distinction. In 1973, he suddenly relocated to Utah, enrolled in the university, and started studying law, stranding his girlfriend, Elizabeth Klupfer, who he had been dating since 1969. He had decided that it was the perfect time to reinitiate contact with Diane, intending to flaunt his new success so that he could lure her back into his arms. It worked, and within a few months, he was showing her off as his fiancée in his political circles, allegedly after she had accepted his marriage proposal. He strung her along for 1 year before executing his actual plan, which meant ghosting her without notice and rejecting all efforts that she made to contact him. When he did eventually answer one of her calls and she asked why he had left, he said, "Diane, I have no idea what you mean." He never spoke to her again. In interviews, he smirked. "I just wanted to prove to myself that I could have married her." Once he had gotten his revenge, he started his murder spree, high off the power that he felt after discarding her in cruel, narcissistic fashion. He repeated this pattern by discarding victim after victim in the worst ways, often feeling conflicted and returning to their corpses to sustain the feeling that he owned and possessed them forever. In an interview, he further explained, "I had this overwhelming fear of rejection that stemmed not just from her, but everything. In there somewhere was a desire to have some sort of revenge on Diane." While Diane chose to live in anonymity after Bundy's crimes were exposed, she reportedly got married to someone else 1 year after her relationship with him ended. In 1976, she accepted an interview with psychologist Dr. L. Carlyle, who published a book titled Violent Mind, the 1976 Psychological Assessment of Ted Bundy. In it, she's referred to as Stephanie Brooks, her chosen pseudonym. Elizabeth Klupfer. Bundy met Elizabeth Klupfer at the Sandpiper Tavern in Seattle in October 1969, saying that he knew that she was the one the moment he laid eyes on her. Elizabeth, Liz, was a divorcee with a 2-year-old daughter who she was raising on her own while working as a secretary. She struggled with alcoholism, which fed Bundy's narcissism as he instantly fulfilled a caring role to her and her daughter, saying that it added a whole new dimension to living, which he had never experienced before. After his first night with her, she was surprised with breakfast the next morning and a trip to Vancouver the following weekend. "The chemistry between us was incredible. I was already planning the wedding and naming the kids. He was telling me that he missed having a kitchen because he loved to cook. Perfect, my prince," she said. They became an instant family of three, enjoying sailing, hiking, camping, and hosting birthday parties together. After a few months, she was introduced to his parents, where they enjoyed a memorable meal together. "I loved her so much, it was destabilizing. She was from a Mormon family with a wealthy background. She was somewhat meek. Liz had a child that she had to raise alone for a time." In 1970, just 4 months after first meeting each other, they applied for a marriage license, which Bundy tore up a few days later during a fight. By 1972, she was pregnant, but decided to terminate the pregnancy, saying, "Both of us knew it would be impossible to have a baby now. He was going to start law school in the fall, and I needed to be able to work to put him through. I was distraught. I knew I was going to terminate the pregnancy as soon as I could. Ted, on the other hand, was pleased with himself. He had fathered a baby." She published her own memoir titled The Phantom Prince, My Life with Ted Bundy in 1981, under pen name Elizabeth Kendall, where she recounts seeing glimpses of his rage, even though she did not understand the extent or context of it at the time. According to the known murders, he had started murdering in February 1974 at a rate of approximately one victim per month. By September, the missing woman had stirred enough fear and investigations for Bundy to know it was time to relocate. There was a description of his car, the name Ted, and composite sketches of the suspect making their rounds. Klupfer confided in her best friend, Marilyn Chino, by showing her the sketches and asking what she thought. "Well, that's Ted, why do you ask?" And then she explained to her that these were the drawings of the suspect for multiple murders in the area, and that his name was Ted. Elizabeth had also started asking him questions about the strange objects she found lying around the house, such as women's underwear, plaster of Paris, and a meat cleaver. When she found a hatchet in his Volkswagen, he told her that he had helped his parents to chop down a tree at their cabin a week earlier. She started to see his darker side when she kept questioning him about items that she found, where he would say, "Tell anyone, and I'll break your fucking neck." On August the 8th, 1974, Elizabeth's suspicions had escalated, and she and Mary Lynn were convinced that he was the man that they were looking for. She called the Seattle Police Department and told them that the suspect was her boyfriend, confessing that he had crutches in his apartment which matched an unsolved attack involving crutches, and that there were several other items of interest in his car. However, the police were overwhelmed with telephonic leads and tip-offs, dismissing her while saying that she would need to come in to fill in a report if she was serious. They also told the woman that the car was specifically bronze and not tan, which gave them some temporary relief in thinking that perhaps it wasn't him. Ted, in the meantime, applied to study law at some of the top universities in the country, but was not accepted, much to his disappointment. He rustled up some reference letters from his psychology professors and reapplied, being accepted into the University of Utah. His professors were so confident in him as an academic with a promising future that they wrote, "I regret Mr. Bundy's decision to pursue a career in law rather than to continue his professional training in psychology. Our loss is your gain." He packed up and moved to Utah, leaving Elizabeth and her daughter Molly in Seattle at short notice. A friend of hers expressed how heartbroken she was when the love of her life just up and left, but Bundy showed very little emotion about his departure, instead focusing his energy on luring Diane Edwards into his calculated revenge trap. Chino said, "He goes to Salt Lake, and guess what? People start to disappear from Salt Lake." They once again alerted the police, but the King County station told her that he had already been cleared as a suspect. In August of 1975, detectives interviewed Klipfer to learn more about Bundy, where she told them that he would get very upset if she wanted to cut her hair, which was long and parted in the middle, something which all of his victims seemed to have in common. She also said that she would sometimes find him examining her body with a flashlight under the covers when she woke up at night. During her interviews with detectives, she learned about Diane Edwards, Stephanie Brooks, for the first time, realizing just how skilled he was at leading a double life. Detectives were able to confirm that Bundy had not been with her on any of the nights that his victims went missing, which must have been a relief for her, in some sense, and also assisted detectives to build a case against him. In March of 1976, Bundy was incarcerated for the attempted kidnapping of Carol DeRonche and convinced Liz of his innocence. He was so convincing that, despite her initial suspicions, she believed him and maintained communication with him through letters and calls, even visiting him throughout his trial. With the help of Alcoholics Anonymous, she got sober and started thinking more clearly, detaching from him physically and emotionally. Before she cut ties with him, she managed to ask him if he had ever tried to kill her, which he admitted he did. One night when she was drunk and asleep in her bedroom, he closed the chimney damper and put a towel under the door, hoping that it would kill her. She suddenly remembered a night where she woke up in a coughing fit, even though her memory was foggy from intoxication, and had not yet made sense of the event. Jim Berlinger's critically acclaimed Netflix film, Wicked, Shockingly Evil and Vile, was inspired by Klipfer's book. She signed off on the script, meeting Zac Efron and Lily Collins, who starred as the couple. Besides her work with the crew on the film, she has managed to live a quiet and low-profile life since Ted's arrest in 1975, grateful that she survived him. Kathy Swindler. Information from the excerpts from The Deliberate Stranger by Richard W. Larson, 1980. In 1968, 19-year-old Kathy Swindler met 21-year-old Ted Bundy when she volunteered to work at the Rockefeller headquarters in Seattle, even though she was a passionate Democrat. President Kennedy had just been assassinated, and the disconsolate Kathy was encouraged to volunteer for Rockefeller's campaign because he was the next best candidate. Ted, a wholehearted Republican, was the office manager and subsequently her supervisor, introducing himself to her with a charming smile, saying, "Hi, I'm Ted Bundy. Welcome to the Rockefeller campaign," which melted her heart. She had medium-length honey blonde hair and blue eyes, and was the daughter of Herb Swindler, who worked for the Seattle Police Department. One afternoon, Ted approached Kathy and asked her out on a date. "Would you like to walk with me up to the public market for lunch?" Which she excitedly accepted. "I almost fell over myself," she said. "Ted Bundy was a figure that people met and loved. I mean, I thought I loved Ted Bundy, not totally in a romantic way, but in terms of being moved by what he said and his feelings for other human beings. If you know him, you can't help but have a great deal of affection for him as a human being. He was very well-dressed and well-mannered, the kind of guy a girl my age would look at and just say, 'Wow,' sort of Kennedy-like." They took a walk down to Seattle's Pike Place Market, where Ted asked if she would like to have a bagel with cream cheese. She said she hadn't had one before, which he found very cute, so they grabbed some at a stall and took their napkin-wrapped bagels down to the waterfront to enjoy them together. He talked about his studies at the University of Washington, his interest in law, and his love for politics. She said that she felt very little girl-like around him and was flattered that he treated her as an equal. Over the following weeks, they went on many more dates, including coffee meetups, movies, and spending time in his apartment together. She remembered that when she first visited his apartment, she waited outside for him because he was running late, and eventually saw him jogging towards her wearing a full tennis outfit, white shorts, white shoes, and a white tennis shirt, with his racket tucked under his arm. "Sorry I'm late," he said, unlocking the door to usher her in. The apartment was very neat and orderly, with a study desk, books on a shelf, and a fold-down bed covered in a crisp white sheet. Once they'd made themselves comfortable, he decided to teach her how to play chess, cautioning her against making any sudden moves. To him, life was like a game of chess, and every move had to be carefully calculated, where one had to strategize exactly what to do in every eventuality. She said that while he was very romantic, their dates only ever included some light kissing and touching, and that he was very gentle with her. When she felt it was all getting a bit much, all she had to do was touch his hand and he would withdraw it. He was always just a perfect gentleman. He was a champion of causes. He was concerned about the situation of the blacks, of all the minorities and the poor. He was unhappy with the injustices of society, and he wanted to do something about them. Why and how Bundy categorized women in his mind is a mystery, with some receiving his tender, loving self, and others meeting the monster in him, in both cases without much provocation. Ironically, Kathy's dad became the chief of the homicide division in the Seattle Police Crimes Against Persons Unit in 1974, which was exactly when women started disappearing at the rate of one per month. The killer? Ted, of course. In hindsight, they asked themselves if Mr. Swindler had ever actually met Ted in person during the time that he was dating his daughter, to which he said, "You know, I just can't remember for certain if I ever did meet him, but you know, I'd sure like to be able to meet him and talk to him now." He moved around and they drifted apart, but because they had not quite officially dated, it also meant that there was no breakup. The last time that Kathy saw him was in 1974, when she descended the stairs of the University of Washington, where she was studying to be a journalist when she saw him cycling past. We both looked at each other, and we saw each other, but we didn't say anything to each other. I often wondered why I didn't say anything. Sandy Gwynn. Information from the Seattle Police Files by Detective Kathleen McChesney. Sandy Gwynn met Ted Bundy in April of 1972 when she was working at Harborview Mental Health Hospital. Ted had been awarded a position there after graduating with a psychology degree, where he worked as a counselor for a few months. Sandy said that while they worked together for several months, she only dated him from June to September in 1972, and that she did not consider him a serious boyfriend. She said that he was very concerned about mental health problems, but came across as quite cold and uncompassionate towards his patients. He always wore navy blue or brown clothing, spoke with slight British overtones, and was sexually aggressive. He liked to go sailing, swimming, and on trips to the beach with her. But she noted that there was always something dangerous that he found fun, like repeatedly pushing her head underwater or having sex with her while he choked her. On one occasion, after they had some lunch and wine at the Humtulips River, he dunked her under the water to the point where she was dizzy and tried to take off her bikini top as he dunked her. When she came up for air, she asked him if he was trying to drown her, which made him chuckle at her. She tied her bikini top in such a tight knot that she had to cut it off when she got home. He continued to dunk her, and when he eventually stopped and she had caught her breath, she went to lie on the rocks, exhausted. Ted followed and tried to untie her bikini top again, but didn't manage, instead ripping off her bottoms and suddenly having sex with her. He did not talk during the sex and pushed his forearm under her chin, choking her as she screamed that she couldn't breathe. She described the experience as very intense, very aggressive. It was as though I really didn't think he was conscious of what he was doing because it wasn't a bonding situation. I was just a body lying there is all. It wasn't as if we were doing something together. Something was being done to me. It was sheer terror. It flashed in my mind that nobody else was around here. She also recalled that he liked to take long drives in Seattle, which he was very familiar with, and often told her about bodies that had been found in some of the woods or somewhere along their route. He even took her to Lake Sammamish to spend the day with her there, the place where he would return in 1974 to abduct and murder two women. At times he would take me for a drive in the hills by Lake Sammamish, and he would drive around and around. I would ask him about it, and he would say he was looking for an aunt. It didn't make any sense because there were only cabins there. It certainly was not residential by any means. It was in the woods. In June, Sandy's car was stolen, something she always suspected him of because he was prone to taking her car without her permission. She later found out that Liz Klupfer's car had also been stolen. He liked to play the victim when confronted about anything, saying that he felt inferior to her and could not offer her the life and entertainment that she deserved. She said that he refused to speak about his father and only spoke about his mother as a weak woman. He also mentioned a younger sister that he was concerned about that had young children that she was struggling to support. Sandy and her roommates found it strange that he had no male friends, something that they didn't like about him. Ted was simultaneously dating Elizabeth Klupfer at the time, who showed up at his house one day when Sandy was in his room. She said that Liz threatened suicide and that it concerned Ted very much. Sandy and Ted broke up, even though he tried to convince her that Liz was just an ex-girlfriend with some mental health problems. He returned to Liz following this breakup, telling her that he felt inferior to her, and that was why he had cheated. She believed him and welcomed him back with open arms. She last saw him in September of 1972, after which she permanently relocated to San Francisco. When Bundy was asked about Gwen, he said that he did not have sexual intercourse with her and that she was a disturbed girl who was giving vent to her imagination. Carol Ann Boone. Carol Ann Boone was a twice-divorced mother of one son when she met Bundy at the Washington State Department of Emergency Services in 1974. They worked together, ironically, on finding missing people, which was later revealed as including many of his victims. Even though he was still dating Elizabeth Klipfer at the time, he hit it off with Carol, and the pair started an office relationship. While the relationship started off platonic, according to Boone, it soon evolved into something romantic. She said, "I liked Ted immediately. We hit it off well. He struck me as being a rather shy person with a lot more going on under the surface than what was on the surface. He certainly was more dignified and restrained than the more certifiable types around the office." In 1975, Ted was arrested when police found a kill kit in his Volkswagen, connecting him to Deborah Kent and Carol DeRonche's cases. In 1976, his trial brought him and Carol Ann closer together, where they exchanged letters and she flew out to spend a week with him in Utah. Once he was captured for the second time, Carol smuggled in $500 in cash to him over 6 months, which helped to facilitate his second escape from prison. In 1978, Bundy was arrested in Florida for the Chi Omega sorority house murders, for which he was found guilty in 1979. Carol had moved to Florida to be closer to him, believing wholeheartedly in his innocence. 6 months later, a second trial took place for the abduction and murder of Kimberly Leach, where Bundy decided to represent himself, putting on a performance that the world would never forget. He called Carol to the stand to question her about their relationship, where she told the jury, "I've never seen anything in Ted that indicates any destructiveness towards any other people. He's a large part of my life. He is vital to me." An obscure Florida law provided that a marriage declaration in court in the presence of a judge constituted a legal marriage, something that Bundy and Boone took full advantage of. A few days earlier, she had applied for a marriage license and, when testifying on Bundy's behalf, answered yes to his marriage proposal, which made the marriage legitimate. Bundy told the jury, "We didn't do this for your benefit. It was the only chance to be in the same room together where the right words could be said. It was something between she and I." On February the 10th, Bundy was sentenced to death for the third time, with Boone still believing that he was innocent. She visited her husband regularly on death row, even smuggling in drugs for him vaginally, which he transported into prison rectally. While Rayford Prison in Florida did not allow conjugal visits at the time, Bundy was great at bribing prison guards and managed to hook up with his wife in the bathroom or behind the water cooler when she visited him. In an interview, she explained, "After the first day, they just didn't care. They walked in on us a couple of times." She got pregnant and gave birth to his daughter, who they named Rose, on October 24, 1981. Carol, her son James, Bundy, and Rose became a little family of four, where they would spend time together when they visited Ted on death row. In April of 1986, when Bundy's execution date had been decided, he decided to confess to his crimes, even though he had denied all allegations for over a decade. When Boone learned of his confessions, she felt deeply hurt by it and his alleged relationship with Diane Weiner, a young Florida attorney who was lobbying for an extension on his execution date. After years of championing his innocence, Boone divorced Bundy and moved back to Washington with their daughter, cutting all ties with him and living out of the spotlight since then. On the evening before his execution, she ignored his phone call. Bundy was executed on January 24, 1989. Carol Ann died in January of 2018 at the age of 70. She had lived in anonymity since she cut ties with Ted, eventually falling ill and spending her last days in a wheelchair at a nursing home.